Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It. Today I have Zach Wiener of Overtime coming to us from Brooklyn. How's your day going, Zach?
It's good. It's a little rainy in Brooklyn. I feel like whenever I call into a podcast or do a remote interview, it's always rainy.
That's probably not, you know, bad thing, right? It's like, at least you're not missing out on gorgeous weather and, you know.
That's true, yeah.
Awesome. So what is Overtime and how'd you come up with this idea?
Yeah, so Overtime was born out of the idea that we feel that kind of the next generation of sports fans, so call it Gen Z, 15 to 25-year-olds, that there is really a hole in the market for a sports media company that is of their voice and really is the formats and type of content that they want to see. And so everything that we do is aimed at that audience and trying to create compelling content and, you know, distribute it to as many people in that demo as possible. And so, you know, in order to do that, we realized we had to do something unique. And I think that if you look at the sports landscape, the sports media landscape, it's very crowded. You know, you have 1,000 bloggers at home writing about Kevin Durant or LeBron James or whoever it may be. And we found that there was actually a lot of white space in the high school sports space. Traditionally, it had been covered in a very, very literal way, like who won, what was the score, what are the stats, what's the schedule, in a very local way. And just, you know, not particularly sexy or cool. And particularly, the coverage was not actually aimed at this 15 to 25-year-old demo. It was aimed at the parents and the coaches and the recruiters. And so we realized that you had these high school stars like Zion Williamson and LaMelo Ball that were on their own building up great followings on Instagram and Twitter, et cetera, and were becoming influencers, but there was not really a media company that was covering them in the way that their peers wanted to see them. And so that really was and still is kind of our entry point into captivating this audience and differentiating as a sports media company in the space.
Interesting. So I did check out the site. It looks like it's mostly basketball players, or at least a lot of basketball players, recording themselves, adding music, kind of making a highlights reel. Am I accurate in stating that?
Yes and no. There's definitely a participatory nature to it in the sense that, you know, any athlete, you know, can upload their highlights to our app and things like that. And you're right, can add music and mixtapes. But the key, though, that we really realized is that, to be honest, most kids are not interested in watching themselves if they know that they're not that good. They're interested in seeing kind of the superstars of tomorrow and the influencers. So we've kind of flipped the model a little bit, and we've empowered fans, and we actually work with probably over 100 remote videographers all across the country to go to the games of these elite players so that we have footage of them all the time. And we're the first ones with the footage. It's never really been done in a real-time way like this before. And so what we do is we have all their highlights. We're distributing them across social media. And then as we continue to kind of build their persona through these highlights, we start to do longer form storytelling. And so, for instance, one of the players that we cover really closely is a kid named Mac McClung. And he's this like 6-foot guy that does amazing dunks and is really incredible. And people want to know more about him because we show him so much. And so now we decided, okay, we're going to go to his hometown. We're going to bring real cameras, a real crew, and see what it's like. And we just released a video called, you know, What It's Like to Become a Celebrity with Mac McClung. And everyone was like, oh my God, this is so cool, behind the scenes, telling his story. And so it's about building up narratives and formats that this audience really loves.
Yeah, very interesting. And who's the customer then? Is it recruiters paying for access to this, or the athletes themselves paying for this, or is it an ad model? Or
honestly, I feel like the recruiter marketplace is just so saturated at this point. Like, there are so many products that recruiters can pay for, athletes can pay for to be seen by recruiters, and it's honestly a little slimy, and we're not really, we never want to charge a kid. I don't really care about the parents or the recruiters. This is all about the end customer or the consumer is really like the 16-year-old, the 17-year-old, the 23-year-old that wants to see this content. And in the short term, the way that we monetize is through brand deals. So, you know, working with a brand that wants to reach this demo and incorporating them into our content or having them sponsor the content, you know, and doing brand deals like that. And then I think longer term, what we want to do is we want to be, you know, a next generation ESPN. We want to have longer form programming, live programming, and we want to be part of a bundle. So we want to be part of Sling TV or Netflix or Hulu or whatever it is. And, you know, we want to be getting, you know, the modern day version of a carriage fee to be like, you know, their sports media provider. We want every kid in America and eventually across the world to say, oh, I'm going to choose that bundle because it has overtime.
Yeah, it's interesting. I like that next gen ESPN. That's a cool tagline or moniker or something. What how'd you come up with this? What were you doing before starting Overtime? What was your background?
Yeah, so when I was in college at the University of Pennsylvania, I had a different sports startup called The Sports Quotient. And the theory behind that was that I was a kid in college and I wanted my voice to be heard, you know, about what I wanted to say in sports, particularly like on an analytical level. And I kind of figured that there were a lot of kids around the country that felt similar to me. So I started a site and, you know, pretty soon we had hundreds of writers writing for this website. And what was interesting was the content was really good. And I would say like the supply of content was great. Like, honestly, the writers did not get paid. We all did it for the love of it. It was not hard to recruit writers. They were easy to work with. It was not hard to manage them. The problem, though, was there wasn't that much demand. And this kind of goes back to what I was speaking about earlier. There are so many freaking articles about everything going on in pro and college sports. And we were a little bit late to the space. So I think from that, I learned that you kind of need to take a unique approach, at least initially, to kind of gain audience and really make a name for yourself.
Interesting. So okay, I see the evolution. Did Sports Quotient evolve into Overtime, or did you sell that and start this after, or what was the?
Yeah, it's a fair question. So no, they're separate, you know, entities, separate businesses. Sports Quotient, you know, so Sports Quotient is mostly, you know, writing and actually a bit of podcasting, and Overtime, we sought out to be, you know, 100% video. And so because of those differences and, you know, just some other reasons, it's you know, it's a totally separate company. Sports Quotient still exists and my co-founder from that company still runs it. And, you know, it's exciting to see it thrive. And I think for the people that write for it, it's still a really special community and special platform for them. But I don't think that it will ever turn into a lucrative business, to be quite honest.
Gotcha. So how long have you been around as Overtime, and how did you bootstrap it in the early days? Did you raise a friends and family or a seed round? What was the initial funding?
Yeah. So it's a pretty unique, you know, kind of inception story. I would say it's unique, not like exhilarating unique, but just unique, like different. So basically, my co-founder, Dan Porter, was the head of digital at William Morris Endeavor. Now renamed Endeavor. And when he was there, he was kind of given the bandwidth to, you know, kind of try a bunch of different experiments within WME. And when I met him, we kind of hit it off and figured out we wanted to do something together in sports. So I joined WME as well. And so, in fact, over time, I mean, we don't officially say this, but essentially it was kind of incubated within WME. They bootstrapped us initially. And so we were WME employees. And, you know, from the get-go, it wasn't called Overtime. There wasn't really anything there. We were working on different products and trying different things out. And then it was actually a little bit over a year ago that we spanned the company out of WME and became, you know, Overtime Sports Inc. That's when we raised our seed round, and that was kind of the next big step for us.
Okay, let's talk about the seed round then. What was how much was it, and was it angel, VC, friends and family, and you know, how'd you raise it?
Yeah. Oh, the I see you put the title in the
there we go. I actually might. Yeah. Subliminally, yes. Subconsciously.
Yeah. So I guess like the raw nuts and bolts to start. We raised $2.5 million. We announced it last January. The lead investor was Graycroft, which is based here in New York. David Stern is a venture partner at Graycroft, so he also invested, which was very important to us and has been really great. And then we had a bunch of smaller funds and a couple angels invest, including 645 Ventures based here in New York, Correlation Ventures, TAC Ventures, basically a bunch of companies that obviously took an interest to us, but also we felt were good partners for what we were trying to achieve.
What was the, so back, you know, that's last January 2017, what was the core of your story? Did you have some pretty impressive traction at that point, or was it more this vision of kind of this next gen ESPN that people gravitated around, or was it your background and your partner's background, or you know, kind of what led people in?
Yeah, it's funny, like I would have given the answer in three parts, and you actually already said kind of the three parts. I think that the first, you know, I think that the macro situation, the macro climate was good and still is good. And I'm sure we'll get to this, but I think it helped us raise our A. I think that, you know, the sports media landscape is going through changes and will continue to go through changes. And as you see rights fees going up for the major sports leagues, and you see TuneIn for both live sports and also SportsCenter type shows going down, and just more competition for attention, particularly for this next generation. I think that was part of it. The macro was good. We had seen some good traction. We were doing 30 million video views a month. And I think that the affinity surrounding our brand and the content that we were creating, it was already apparent that it was, different and very authentic. So I think that helped. But I think that really the main thing, and I actually know this from, you know, from later on talking to some of our investors, you know, I think initially for seed rounds, it comes down to the team. And I think that they liked a couple things about our team. I think, first of all, they liked the fact that Dan is double my age. So it's kind of an interesting pairing. I'm 25 and I won't say his exact age, but I already said he's double my age.
Double your age. You can do the math, yeah.
Right. So I think that they like that. I think that they liked my experience in sports and having kind of, you know, being in the demo that we were and are trying to hit. I think they like that. Dan is, you know, I guess you could say a serial entrepreneur or a multiple-time entrepreneur, has already sold a couple businesses and done pretty well there. They like that. I think they like the way that we pitched it. And I think, yeah, they got excited about it.
So 30 million views a month, video views a month, that's a lot. That's a big number. How long did it take you to build that? And how did you, I'm sure that's, we could probably spend an hour talking about how you built that level of traffic and traction, but you know, what's the sort of summary version of how you built such an impressive number?
Yeah. Again, I think it comes down to the fact that like not a lot of people were doing what we were doing. And I think that, you know, what really helped us and still helps us is that these athletes that we cover are so big in their own right, but they're also raw in the sense that like they become a point of distribution. So like if I take a highlight of LeBron James, first of all, it's borderline illegal. Like the NBA probably won't ask you to take it down, but there are rights issues, whatever. Okay. Maybe you're allowed to put it up. But LeBron James is not going to go then post that highlight on his Instagram or his Twitter or on his Facebook page. Whereas with high school players, that's actually exactly what they do. You'll make a mixtape for them, or you'll make a fun video surrounding them. And they get hyped and they say, oh, check this out. And so I think that, the athletes being such proponents of our brand and the content that we were creating had a large part in having some initial quick growth.
So, okay, but that was your seed round. Before that, to get to that 30 million views a month, were you sending out these professional videographers? Did you identify some of the, you know, the up-and-coming stars, send out the videographers to record them, and then use them as the point of distribution? I mean, maybe rewind me a little bit further, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, through kind of trial and error, yeah, that's basically what happened. You know, one of the things we realized, and I think that's something that is positive about our business, is the cost structure is pretty good. I mean, we've realized that footage from your iPhone is good enough to be on TV. I mean, ESPN now uses our clips all the time. And so, you know, when you say we send professional videographers, do we pay people to go? Yes. But, are, you know, is it with a professional camera? Is it, does it cost thousands of dollars an hour? Absolutely not. We do a lot of trial and error, and we did in the beginning about figuring out which athletes drive views, who has good stories, who's an influencer. And because we were getting the footage in real time, because it was shot with the phone, we were the first to it. And there was something just very raw and organic about it that I think made people kind of tune into it and want to see it.
Okay. How long did it take you to get to that 30 million views? Are we talking a year or 2 years longer?
I would say it took us probably 8 months or so.
Wow. Amazing.
Which, yeah, it is kind of crazy. And I think, again, it kind of goes back to my sports quotient, analogy. Like with sports quotient, it was just such a crowded space. And I think that we're lucky that we found kind of a white space here that is a lot less crowded. And there's a lot of room for innovation.
Were you able to use Sports Quotient's audience and network to seed Overtime's audience? I mean, is there a – or?
Yeah. It's a good question. I think something that was interesting at the time and still interesting looking back is that because I had different partners in each business, I was very careful not to blur the lines. I didn't want my Sports Quotient co-founders and everyone that was involved there to feel like, oh, I'm on to this next thing and I'm going to leverage all the resources that I have from a previous business for the advantage of this new business that you guys aren't a part of. So I was very conscious not to do that, to be honest. I don't really feel like it held Overtime back. I felt like the audience segment was different. The type of content that we were providing was different. It was something that I thought about, but pretty purposefully did not do.
Gotcha. Okay, so you ended up, or Greg Kraft led the round, David Stern put in money, and then how did you identify Greg Kraft as the lead? Did you run a competitive process, or did you already have a relationship with those guys? You know?
So Dan, my co-founder, fortunately has a lot of relationships. Certainly relationships do not lead to term sheets. It's not like, oh, hey, I know this guy. Okay. Let's give him a flyer. But it certainly helps, to know people. So Dan knows Alan Patrickoff, who's not super well, but knows the guy who founded the firm. For us though, Greg Kraft was really the perfect leader. First of all, I think we wanted someone based in New York for the seed round, just because, you know, we were still a small company and we wanted an investor that would really kind of be a little more involved. And then, to be honest, David Stern had a lot to do with it. As we think about the future of our company and, there are things that we may want to do with the NBA in the future. And David is just so amazing. Not just in terms of connections, but his insights and, obviously giving legitimacy to our company. So when we were looking at the ecosystem and realized that David was involved with Greg Kraft, obviously Greg Kraft is an amazing firm on their own. And, we probably still would have wanted to go with them anyway. But he was really kind of the cherry on the top.
Great. Do you have any sense of how many firms you talked to before landing on Greg Kraft?
Ooh. I don't know. I mean, I would say as soon as we started the project, we started to talk to people informally just to get a sense of where the market was, and who might be a good partner. And we definitely talked to some people that didn't even really do seed rounds. So, and I wouldn't say it was a waste of our time or we were just spinning our wheels. I think that it was kind of a learning process. I don't know if I have an exact estimation. You know, maybe a couple dozen throughout the process. But, you know, that was over a longer time period where, you know, sometimes we're meeting with people and specifically saying, like, actually, we're not raising right now. And, and that was true initially. We weren't really.
And sometimes saying you're not raising almost makes them want to come in sometimes, you know, if they like what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of that.
That can be very true, definitely.
So that was January 2017. And so tell me about the decision to raise, I guess, your proper Series A, right, which you just completed recently.
Yeah. So I think that, like, in this past year, you know, we've seen – I don't want to say explosive growth, but we've seen very good growth. Just for context, this past January, we did 150 million video views. So 5x growth off of a number that we had been pretty happy with last January. So, you know, the metrics that we really track are video views, engagement rates. And so our engagement rates are kind of industry high across sports media companies. So that that's kind of a very important metric for us. And then also watch time. We want to make sure that people are watching a lot of our content when they see it. And so those metrics have been trending really well. And basically we just think that there's so much opportunity here that we want to capitalize on it fast before, you know, someone else maybe slips into the market. And we want to make the moat as big as possible until everyone figures out, oh man, these guys are really onto something. And then it's kind of too late. And then they either got to partner with us or buy us or invest in us. And so I think that was really the impetus.
Yeah. So yeah, you weren't running out of money. I like this metaphor of making the moat as big as possible. That's great. So tell me about this latest round, which I think you just announced it this month, right? February.
Yeah, we announced it. I think last week. You're right on time.
Good timing is everything. Yes.
Yeah.
When did you start raising it? And just tell us about the round. How big is it? And lead investors, stuff like that.
Yeah. So the round is for $9.5 million, which is still crazy to say, like, as a number. it's a lot of money. We have a lot of things we need to do with it, and, you know, quite frankly, it's never enough. But it's really amazing to have raised that, and obviously we're very thankful, and I'm very thankful. But so the lead investor was Andreessen Horowitz, and the partner that led it from there is Jeff Jordan. And I mean, we're just super stoked to be working with them. You know, they're the type of VC that even my mom knows who they are, which is just you know, it's not a reason to choose a VC, but it's just a cool cherry on top. Awesome. But really, Jeff, you know, Jeff is amazing. He's a big sports fan, which, you know, for our business is actually really important. Just, I think, really aligns with the way that we see the macro environment. And he actually wrote a blog post last week about the investment, and I think that it kind of showed that. And yeah, I think that, you know, he wants to be a little bit more hands off, which is good for us. I mean, Dan is a very seasoned entrepreneur, and I think that we have a good sense of where we're headed, and, you know, don't need, I don't want to say interference, it wouldn't be interference, but, you know, we don't feel like we need tons and tons of guidance. We just need, you know, the resources to get done what we need to get done. And so they're really a perfect partner for us. And then, you know, a bunch of our current investors re-upped with us. And then we brought on a couple strategics, including the ex-CEO of Time Warner, Dick Parsons, including David Pish, Box Group, including Michael Spirito, who is seasoned in this space, and same with George Yang, who we're excited to have too. So I think it's honestly an amazing group of investors to have.
I mean, those are all amazing names. So, you know, Andreessen Horowitz, I think my mom would know who she is too. So that's pretty cool. That's funny. Tell me about Raising Around. So when did you start raising it, and how did you, I mean, these are some amazing names. So how did you identify this target list, you know, kind of unpack it a bit for me, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So what's interesting is we actually closed the round. We knew it was going to happen in November, and then like the paperwork and stuff was officially signed in December. But we decided to wait to announce the round because we wanted to do it leading up to the NBA All-Star game, which, you know, I was out there last week in LA, and I was at the Tech Summit and a bunch of different events. And I'm very happy we made that decision because, you know, I felt like we were kind of on the tip of everyone's tongue, which was cool. And it just makes networking a lot easier, and networking leads to business relationships, et cetera. So, so it's actually been a couple months since we knew. The process, I think that Dan and I approach it similarly to how we approach the seed, like, you know, not always be raising, but always be, you know, talking to people. And so, you know, really right after we raised our seed, we started to get a little bit of interest, and we said, you know, we're not obviously not ready for an A right away. But then I think, you know, over the summer, we had some really good signs of how things were starting to trend. And so kind of late summer, we started more seriously talking to some folks, and then really got going in the fall. And had a lot of really interested parties, and we actually, in the end, were oversubscribed, which is obviously humbling. I think that each of these investors that we brought on brings unique value and you know, good people that we actually want to talk to and work with, which is important too.
You went outside New York, obviously. Andreessen's on West Coast. Was that a conscious decision, or you just started talking to folks that were good fits?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's strategic. I mean, you know, I guess there's something to having, like, you know, a major investor in Graycroft in New York and a major one in the West Coast. You know, I think if anything, that would be more for just like the financing networking. Like, you know, I think for our, you know, hopeful B in the future, you know, I guess theoretically it's helpful to have investors that are well connected on both coasts. But I think when you talk about any of these big VCs, they're very well connected. And I wouldn't say it was overly important, the location of the VC for the A round.
I noticed that Kevin Durant's holding company, I think, is listed.
I forgot the most exciting name, or not that I forgot, but like to me that's just like its own thing in a way that is like the most exciting thing ever. So KD, or you know, his VC group invested in us, which is very validating, and it's validating for us internally, but it's just validating for us as a brand to our consumers when, you know, athletes and fans and kids know that Kevin Durant is part of this. It's very validating. It's very exciting.
You probably saw it. There was a good article on him in, I think, Wired magazine very recently about how
he's been everywhere. He's in Wired, Fast Company, New York Times. His PR people do a good job.
Yeah. Well, what was fascinating is the way he's like very systematically approaching getting into tech investing and startups, and, you know, like he's not dumb money. I mean, he's very, you know, thoughtful in how he's going about it. It's cool.
No, totally. I think if you look at his investment portfolio, you know, it speaks for itself. But yeah, no, he's not just, you know, he's not just a quote unquote jock. I mean, he's a smart guy that has good people around him. We work very closely with Rich Kleiman, you know, his business manager, who's great. And I think this is a natural fit. Like, you know, KD, before he invested in us, like he saw our content, he was a user essentially. So it's very natural, and it makes a big difference for where we want to go.
So, you know, that's really amazing. With such a kind of all-star group of investors, how do you, or how will you, because this is pretty, still ink is barely dry on this, but how will you activate them? How will you leverage and engage and get the most out of this set of investors what are you doing?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we do, which I think is really important, and it's not unique to us. I mean, it's kind of like tried and true advice, but we send a monthly update to all of our investors. And I think that's important because, you know, the two ways that investors are going to help you or anyone is going to help you, it's either going to be push or pull. Either you're going to ask them for something or they're going to come to you with an idea or a resource or a networking opportunity. And I think when you send a monthly update that's both true and also somewhat in-depth and really meaningful, I think that it makes both of those things easier, right? Like, so if I reach out to, you know, one of our investors every 4 months asking for something, he doesn't have any, he or she does not have any context. He or she, you know, obviously their money is invested, so they feel invested, but you want them to feel like they're living the journey too, because they are. And so I think, you know, when it comes to asking for things, I think that it's good that they're more top of mind. And then certainly in the other direction, if you expect your investors to come to you with opportunities, they need to know what's going on in your business. They need to know what's relevant. And so I think it's definitely important to keep them updated. You know, you don't want to write a saga. It's not going to be, you know, 5 pages long, but you want to keep them afloat as to the important things that are driving your business or where your pain points are.
Do you specific, how long do you spend on each monthly update, plus or minus? And do you specifically, you know, ask for specific help from people on their distribution list, or is it more general?
Yeah. I don't think it's not like we're like debating over days what to put in there. Dan and I just kind of talk like these are the major things, and then it's kind of free form, like, you know, obviously we don't want typos or whatever, but like, you know, it's not something that we're like super laborious over, because, you know, it's just being distributed internally. It's kind of from the heart. What was the, there was like a two part question, right?
Do you put in specific like asks or requests for help?
I would say not as a rule. Like it's not like every single month we have to think of a way to activate our investors. But I would say like probably every other month there's like a semi-specific ask. It could also be a little more vague, like platform relationships, meaning like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter are like really important to us right now. You know, if you know anyone at these organizations, ping us and, you know, happy to talk to them, those type of things. Or it could be like, we're looking for a chief content officer. If you know anyone that's really good, like very specific, let us know.
Yeah. Interesting. Cool. A couple more questions. I'll let you get back to work, but, how do you think about fundraising going forward? You've obviously raised kind of a lot of money in a fairly short amount of time. Do you think, have you seen competitors emerge? Do you need to build that moat even wider? Do you think this is going to be Series E by the time all things are done? What are you thinking?
I don't know. I mean, I would say, you know, part of, as I even said, and you just referenced, part of the reason for raising the money so that we can move fast, so we can build a moat. But like, when I think about building the moat, you know, raising the money is not the most important thing to building the moat. It's what we do with that money and how quickly we can actually execute and the people that we hire and just in general, the execution. So I would say right now I'm not waking up every single day thinking about how can we raise more money, and that's going to be our differentiator. I'm thinking about, how can we create content that this generation loves? How can we distribute it to more people? How can we bring on more brands to make money, to increase our runway? We've gotten more inbound recently with the news, and I think we'll hopefully continue to get more inbound. But, you know, it's more just on a case-by-case basis. I think it'll be probably another year before we even think about like really going out or another round, but you never know. I mean, the right partner could come along, the right opportunity could come along, and you never know.
Do you find you've raised kind of a lot of money in a fairly short amount of time? Do you find it, it's kind of a almost ironic that some startups, when they have all this money, they start to get too unfocused, spread thin. If you're not restricted by being lean and mean, sometimes it gets companies spread all over. Do you find any of that? I know the money's still pretty fresh in the bank, but like, has the culture changed now with all this money in the bank?
No, I mean, yeah, it's a very fair question. I think that we were kind of bursting at the seams to begin with, and we had a lot of specific needs. So, you know, I mean, no company would say that they do this anyway, but it's certainly not like we're just like hiring just to hire. But I think that we've seen like tiny glimpses of how, as our team expands, the culture could be compromised. And I think that Dan and I are very conscious of combating that and nipping anything like that in the bud. And certainly, like, you know, more processes have and will continue to be put in place as the company grows to make sure there's that solid foundation. Yeah, I mean, it, you know, that's our job as the company grows, for the culture to remain positive and for all the pieces to be valuable on their own, but be even more valuable as they work together.
Yeah, really good. All right, last question. If you could give yourself, I mean, I love it. You're 25 and you're, you know, on this rocket ship and it sounds like you're having a great time doing it. If there's any piece of advice you could give your younger self when you were starting the business or starting to fundraise, what would it be?
It's the same advice that I'd say to myself yesterday, which is like, don't stress so much. Like, it's going to be good. Like, just as you said, like, I couldn't be more thrilled, and like, my life is really great. I'm so lucky. And I wish that I would have and still continue to stop and smell the roses a little bit more. And I think that I'm grateful, but I think that I could enjoy it a little bit more, because if you're not enjoying it, what's the point? So
that's right. That's right. All right, Zach, appreciate it. This is really exciting to talk to you and hear all this really good stuff. Very insightful and exciting, frankly. So I'll be keeping an eye on you guys, and I wish you continued success. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Cheers. Bye.